In a Premier League football match recently, a fan in the crowd was taken ill, and the match had to be stopped while he received emergency medical treatment and was taken to hospital. Thankfully, he came through, he survived. But one of the match commentators typed up online, said, "Please let him be all right." And it was a nice thought, I thought, but who was he asking? Who was he asking? To whom was the pleas addressed? Politicians, of course, regularly say that their prayers are with people who've experienced tragedy. I've been cynical at all. One wants to ask, well, to whom are they praying? And what are these prayers that are going to be with people? The tragic murders of Sarah Everard and Sabina Nessa this year, and then the MP, Sir David Amos, a couple of weeks ago, were marked by vigils. Crowds gathering with candles. Now, no doubt there's a number of different motives leading to all that. And in terms of David Amos, who was a devout Roman Catholic, no doubt very religious motives too. But I couldn't help thinking there's something very religious in these incidents and in these expressions. They remind us that however secular a society tries to be, however embarrassed people in public life, at least in Europe, may be about confessing faith in a God, religion in some form is very deep-seated in the human heart. It's too deep-rooted to be dismissed as just social conditioning. There's a very difficult to erase sense within people of there being someone, a power, something that is greater than us, and indeed sometimes we need to turn to him. Now this is a part, or it's not all, of what Paul is saying in verses 18 to 23 of Romans chapter 1. He has briefly set out the heart of the gospel in verses 16 and 17. He said, the gospel is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. In it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. As it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. But before explaining it in detail, he then tells us why the gospel is needed. And this really takes up the rest of chapter 1, chapter 2, and half of chapter 3. In chapter 1, the rest of it, he's telling us why the Gentiles need the gospel. And it's because they deserve wrath, and he tells us why they deserve wrath. And then in chapter 2, he moves on to tell why the Jews in particular need the gospel. And it's because they are under wrath. And in chapter 3, verse 19, he, as it were, concludes what he's saying. He says that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight. By our own good deeds, as we like to call them, no one is going to be right with God. You need the gospel revealed by God. And so what he is saying really in these verses is that there are three things interweaving. There is, firstly, a wrath of God is revealed. It says that in verse 18. Why? Because there's been a rebellion of human beings against God. What have they rebelled against? God's revelation of himself in creation. So it makes sense, really, to look at it beginning with that first. And this is the order in which I'll do things this morning. The revelation of God in creation. The rebellion of man against God. And then very briefly, because I want to deal with it far more fully in a couple of weeks' time, the wrath of God being revealed against man's rebellion. But when we read this, and when we go into chapter 1, verse 18 onwards, it's quite a dark description. It's quite a dark passage, in a way. And it's an essential passage, an important passage. It's one that we need to take to heart and one we need to understand, because otherwise you don't really understand why the gospel has come. If you don't understand the bad news, you don't understand the bad news, you don't understand the good news. If you don't understand your sickness, the doctor can't treat you and give you the right medicine. So we need to understand the sickness. This is a kind of medical diagnosis of the spiritual condition of human beings. But please remember, the reason it's been given is not just to be morbid, or not just to be unkind to people, or make us feel guilty, or make us feel bad. It's to make us understand why we need the gospel and to help us to reach out to Jesus Christ for the righteousness that is in him. So let's look firstly at revelation then. The revelation of God in creation. Verses 18, 19, and 20. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Then verse 19. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. Right, what's what Paul's saying here then? Firstly, what is made known? What is it that's revealed? Well, it's what can be known about God. What is that? Well, in particular, Paul says in verse 20, his invisible attributes. In other words, invisible things are made known. Invisible things are seen. Interesting, isn't it? What are those invisible things in particular? His eternal power and divine nature. Right? Eternal power. By which he created the world. By which he made the world. His divine nature. His godness, we might say. That which he is in himself. That he is God. How do we think these are reflected with us? Well, Paul doesn't actually say that, but he says they very clearly are seen by us. Is it not possible that divine power is reflected in our sense of smallness, our sense of dependence, right? Isn't that a common feature of humanity, that we feel sometimes small? You hear, see people who've got no particular Christian belief. They will look outside at the stars and the sky and will feel very, very, very tiny, very small, very insignificant. Is there something more than the hugeness of the cosmos in that? Is there something that actually God is saying, you are very small, you are very tiny? We feel dependent. His deity, is that behind this instinct to worship that I was talking about? This universal instinct to worship God? Is that where it comes from? Possibly also the idea that we are accountable to somebody? The sense of guilt that people have, which they can't often define? The sense of being finite? However we are to try to understand it, certainly something of God is clearly perceived. And notice it's not just that he's the designer. I think we're very conscious in recent generations of people trying to show that design leads to a designer, that Christians were keen to show that because the world is designed that there is a designer behind it. And that's all very well, and it's not a false argument, but other non-Christian religions can use that argument as well. Paul is not just saying that there is a creator. Please remember that. Paul is not simply saying here there's a creator behind everything. He is actually telling us something about what this creator is like. And that's different. He is saying he is a God of eternal power and divine nature. It isn't just an argument from design that Paul is giving us here. That's not a wrong argument, but it's not the one that Paul is using here. He's saying that this God, it is much more serious to rebel against one who is of eternal power and divine nature than simply to refuse to recognize a designer behind everything. So that's what made known then, his eternal power and divine nature. Where is it made known? Where is it made known? Well, it's made known in the things that have been made. In the things that have been made, Paul said. You think of the sun and the moon and the stars and the planets, the world system, day and night and seasons, light and dark, sky and seas, the vegetation, rivers, trees, lakes, beautiful things we love to look at, the things mentioned in Genesis chapter 1, fish and birds, animals and reptiles. You and me. You and me. Atheistic evolution, of course, argues that we are just the topmost event of evolution, the topmost achievement of evolution. I can't help thinking that if a visitor from outer space, the proverbial visitor from outer space, landed on our planet and never seen anyone before and looked at human beings and contrasted and compared us with all other animals, he would say, oh, this is a different thing here. This species, however you explain it, is a quantum leap beyond anything else. This isn't just a well-developed ape. There's something totally different here. What other animal has got anywhere close to the kind of dominion over the earth with all the achievements and all the technology and all the science and all the art that human beings have achieved? There's something different here. And this shows something of God. Shows something of God. Creativity. Many other things. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky proclaims his handiwork, says Psalm 19. There's also a moral sense of right and wrong, but we'll be dealing with that when Paul raises it in chapter 2. I won't deal with that here. I don't think it's in the foremost of Paul's thoughts here in chapter 1. But what Paul is concerned to say in chapter 1 here is this: you know there is a God. That's what he's saying. You may profess to be an atheist, you may worship one of multiple other gods and idols, you may have, but whatever your religious profession or lack of it, you know there is a God. That's what Paul is saying. How is it revealed? Well, simply, God has revealed it. God has made it plain, he says. He emphasizes it, doesn't he? What can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. And he says that these things have been clearly perceived. He emphasizes it. These things are not obscure, not in the original creation anyway. They're not perceived by only spiritual geniuses, as they're sometimes called. People of special perception, high flyers in the theological world, perhaps. Every human being, and it's not a matter of intellectual capacities, every human being perceives what can be known about God because God has made it plain. And that's both very challenging, as Paul will see later on, but it's also a great encouragement. It means that there is some residuum of faith in God in people who may seem to be the least hopeful when it comes to reaching them with the gospel. And surely experience and reading biographies will show you that some people who seem furthest away from God and from Christ, something will trigger something off within them. And of course, that's the Holy Spirit giving a new birth. But there is something there to work with in human beings. You see, there is something in human beings to work with. And of course, it helps us in our witness and evangelism, but that's another story. There's no doubt about these things that God has revealed. Two points to make. One is, they are, of course, obscured by sin. When you look at the world, when you look at human beings, we don't see God as clearly as Adam and Eve might have done in the Garden of Eden. The revelation of God is like a light shining on the world, but the lens covering that light is dirty, dusty, cracked, and it obscures, as it were, because of sin. There's nothing wrong with the revelation, it's sin that has obscured it. It doesn't mean to say it isn't there, it is there within us, but it's not as clear as it once was, before the fall. And the second point to say about this knowledge of God is it doesn't save you. When Paul talks here about people knowing God, and he does, you might think, oh, well, Jesus says eternal life is to know you, the one true God, and Jesus Christ, whom he has sent. And you think, oh, well, Paul says everybody knows God, so everybody is saved then, isn't it? Everyone's all right. Everyone's right with God. No. It's a different knowledge. This is a kind of basic created knowledge in human beings, which, as we will see, actually leads to our condemnation because we reject it. It's not the same as knowing God in Jesus Christ. It's not the knowledge of being saved. It's not the knowledge that comes through grace. It's not the knowledge of God that comes through the gospel. It's not the knowledge of God that repairs what's cracked and washes off the dust and the pollution of sin. Paul is preaching the gospel because this knowledge of God he's referring to in Romans chapter 1 is not enough to save you. You need something clearer and better. You need to be brought back to God, and you need it through the blood of Jesus Christ. And when is it revealed? This is the next question. When is this revealed? Well, from the beginning of creation and now and always. The wrath of God is revealed, Paul says. It's not just something that happened at the beginning of the Garden of Eden. It is going on. It is being revealed from heaven. There is an ongoing revelation of this knowledge of God. Linked to this, Paul in Acts chapter 14, on his missionary journeys, said at Lystra, when the people there, the pagan people, were trying to worship Barnabas and Paul. It's interesting, you see, this idea of worship came. They wanted to worship Barnabas and Paul. And Paul said, horror, no. We also are many, said, of like nature with you, and we bring you good news that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In past generations, he allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways, yet he did not leave himself without witness, for he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. So God has, the idea of harvest, you could say, and rains and fruitful seasons are a witness to God. So the revelation is still going on. Okay, then what difference then? Briefly then, what difference does this make, this revelation of God in creation? I'll come on to the rebellion in a moment. What difference does this revelation of God in creation make? Firstly, we instinctively want to worship, to praise, and to pray. There is also fear of God. There is some kind of deep-rooted sense of a being. I know many people would deny that, and they say they've not felt it, and they've said, but I think the general pattern is this, that, and even when you see it today, the instances I gave at the beginning of the sermon, for example, have you noticed how quickly adulation of a sports or a cultural hero turns into something quasi-religious? They put people on a pedestal so quickly. Why do we do that? And then they do something wrong, and they topple, and they're condemned, and they're despised after that. Modern students of culture, and there are plenty of them, talk about fandom as being quasi-religious. Now, you know, years ago, you were a fan of something, maybe a football team, or you enjoyed going to see a play in a theatre, and you just enjoyed it, and you followed them with loyalty. Now, fandom is something quasi-religious. And the social media has increased that immensely. Not caused it, it just increased it. I don't know how much anybody here knows about the Harry Potter phenomenon, but in 20 years there are hundreds of thousands, millions of people throughout the world who are engaged, for whom their life revolves around Harry Potter. They actually think that Severus Snape is a real man, and how dare J.K. Rowling mess with him and change and this kind of thing. People are just absorbed in this kind of fictional world that someone else has created. But she's now rejected, of course. They've taken it over. And there are other things, many, many things like that in the world of the internet. But the people point out that here people are seeing a kind of quasi-religious phenomenon that in these things, people get a sense of purpose, that the world has a purpose to do with their particular thing, not Harry Potter necessarily, that their life has a meaning, it gives their life a meaning, which is an awful thing if your meaning in your life depends on a fictional character. The third thing is community, because it gets people together. And that's a kind of function of religion. And rituals as well, I think, the vigil thing, the candles and all that. It'd be interesting to go around asking all those individuals, why are you doing this? What do you think you're doing? So you get those features of religion, really, which are all there in these things. And you could argue that, and you could say there are other things as well. There are more formal religions as well. But it's clear that the religious instinct is pretty powerful in human beings, despite all the attempts of people to dismiss it. So we instinctive religion, we may seek God as well. This is another implication of this revelation of God. Acts chapter 17, speaking to the Athenians in the Areopagus in Athens, Paul said this, that God, he made from one nation, every nation of mankind, he made from one man, every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way towards him and find him. But he's actually not far from any of them. So there's a possibility of human beings seeking God. Another feature of it is that we know what's wrong and that it deserves death. In chapter 1 of Romans, verse 32, Paul says this, though they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die. That's an astonishing statement. It means that human beings know that things are wrong and deserve paternal death as a punishment. They not only do them, how many people do what they know to be wrong? All of us. But he says there are those who also give approval to those who practice them. They sort of encourage it and promote it. And we're without excuse on the day of judgment. So they are without excuse. Christians are sometimes put in the position of saying you've got to justify your belief in God as if you're the ones without excuse for not being an atheist. No, says the Bible. No, says Paul. You unbeliever are the one who's without excuse. Bertrand Russell is only one of many who has said, he's a 20th century philosopher, who said he would say to God why he didn't believe in him, I never knew you existed. Not enough evidence. But there is. There is. And the evidence of moral sense, of religious nature, in human beings is evidence itself that we are aware of something beyond and greater than ourselves. So that's the revelation of God. What about the rebellion against it? What about the rebellion against it? Well, Paul calls it in verse 18, ungodliness and unrighteousness. Ungodliness, we could say, is the attack on God's majesty. Unrighteousness, we could say, is breaking God's laws, if you wanted to just define them like that. An attack on his majesty and a breaking of his laws. That's Paul's general description of the human condition today. We are in rebellion against God, and we have broken his laws. How did that happen? Well, we suppress the truth in unrighteousness, verse 18. Right, we suppress it, we keep it under. The truth of who God is that is there in what he has revealed about himself is kept under. Adam and Eve, as it were, did so. They denied the truth that they knew about God when the serpent lied to them. And ever since, we resist, keep down, sit on the truth that we know in our hearts about God. It's not that God is difficult to find, it's that we, like Adam and Eve after sin, are hiding from him. Now, of course, people don't see it like that. They rationalize it. They make up a theory. They make up a philosophy. I'm sure some of you will have read Richard Dawkins sometime in the last 20 years or so. And he said that Darwinism enabled him to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. An interesting phrase. Darwinism enabled him to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. He had been an atheist before, he said. In other words, somebody who didn't believe in God. But Darwinism helped him to justify it. Right? It gave him an alternative and, to him, credible theory of origins. And that's what the theory of evolution, as it's so usually promoted, does. It gives a theory of origins that dismisses the existence of God. For many people, anyway, for most people. There's far more to origins about. There's far more than origins to God. Not just about origins. It is important, but it's about what lies behind your conscience, your sense of what's right and wrong. What lies behind your feelings about things, your emotions? What lies behind this sense that life is more than the material? What lies behind your aversion to death? What lies behind your ability to love? What lies behind your sense of a purpose in life? That God is in these things and much more is what is suppressed. And in verses 21 to 23, Paul charts four steps we can see in verses 21 to 23 of how this suppression takes place. The first is contempt. He says they do not honor God. Although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. That's the first thing. Just simply ignore him. You don't worship him. You don't thank him. Are you thankful to God? Do we thank God every day for the mercies he gives us? Ingratitude is one of the first signs of unbelief. The first step to idolatry. And the second step of the four is folly. He says they became futile in their thinking. Their speculations, and the mind that rejects the truth will soon be mired in error. It's inevitable. If you don't fill your mind with truth, you're going to fill it with something. And there are philosophies to explain life and its origin and meaning. False religions abound. In Ephesians, Paul says this, talking about the Gentiles and the futility of their minds, chapter 4, verse 17 of Ephesians. They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to their hardness of heart. In other words, that false thinking comes from hardened hearts. Now, let me just say this. Paul is not denying that unbelievers know an awful lot of truth about an awful lot of things in many spheres of life. You and I know that. You go to a good non-Christian dentist because he's a good dentist and knows more about your teeth than you do. Or a doctor. Or a lawyer. Or an accountant. Or a teacher. All of these things. We're thankful, as Calvin says, that the gifts of God's Holy Spirit have been scattered abroad and are not just confined to Christians. Of course there are. You don't have to be a Christian to understand the theory of gravity or relativity or know that murder is wrong or that boiling water scalds you. Of course you don't. And non-Christians in every sphere of life know these things. But firstly, if I can put it like this, they don't know why they know these things. What is the ultimate cause from which these things come? Why are there laws of science and not just a series of coincidences? Why can we rely on the world being as it is? Where does the moral sense come from? How can we keep saying that's wrong unless we have somewhere firm in which we're standing? The second thing is, and this is Paul's main point, they have no grasp on spiritual truth. The most brilliant scientist, the most ingenious artist, the most gifted politician, they have no way of knowing God apart from the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's the tragedy. In spiritual things, their minds are darkened and thoughts are futile. And that's why they need a further revelation of God's righteousness. You have the revelation of God in nature. You have the revelation of his wrath, which I'll come to, and you have then a revelation of God's righteousness. Because we need that third revelation to give us hope. So, contempt, folly. Thirdly, pride, claiming to be wise. And don't people claim to be wise today? How people assert their knowledge, how proud skeptics, unbelievers are, how they belittle and deride faith, particularly Christian faith. How could you possibly believe that there are only two genders? We know that there are, well, scores, dozens. So there's that pride in human beings. Christians must be aware of it as well. But claiming to be wise, they became fools. And the implication is that because they claimed to be wise, they became fools. Because they set themselves up as above God, they became fools. And that leads to the fourth thing, idolatry. So you have contempt, futility, pride, and idolatry. They exchanged the glory of the immortal God. What a thing to do, to exchange the glory of the immortal God who created us, who is the one who is the possessor of eternal power and divine nature. You exchange that for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Well, today, what would you have? Jeremiah rather amusingly calls idols like cucumbers in a field, he says. Or no, scarecrows in a cucumber field. Scarecrows in a cucumber field. What are today's idols? Well, I mentioned some of them, with things that are kind of group people together, largely through social media, but not only so. But there are many idols. Our money can be an idol for us. Pleasure can be an idol for us. Power can be an idol for some. Perhaps the freedom to be whatever I want is the great idol today. How dare anybody challenge my freedom to be what I want to be and to choose my identity, even my sexual identity, if I wish? Right? That is perhaps the biggest idol today. It's this idea of absolute freedom. Claiming to be wise, they became foolish. Well, that's man's rebellion then. Summarized, contempt, futility, pride, idolatry. Very briefly, I'll just mention this because I want to spend more time on it from verse 24 onwards. It's from there on that Paul deals with wrath. The wrath of God. It has to be said that whilst God is a God of love, God is also angry with sinners. And it's not just angry with sin. He's angry with people who sin. And God's anger is not like our anger. It's not petulant and quick-tempered. It's not arbitrary and self-indulgent. It's not vicious and sometimes cruel like our anger so often is. God's wrath is personal, it is holy, it is intense, it is his antagonism to everything that contradicts his holiness. It is his antagonism to everything that is against what he is. And this anger of God, of course, is just and holy, and it is compatible with the love and the mercy shown in the gospel. But this anger is being revealed against human ungodliness and unrighteousness. And notice that, whilst God's nature is being revealed, that's going on now. You're experiencing it, we're experiencing it, the world is experiencing it, that God's nature is being revealed, the invisible attributes are being revealed, so is God's wrath being revealed. It's not something which just happened long ago, perhaps in the flood, or certain periods in Israel's history, or when there are earthquakes, or when there are terrible floods, or when there are fires or disasters, or when there's a pandemic. It is an ongoing thing in human life at all times. That is the way God's wrath is being revealed. So we don't just say, oh, this pandemic, God's wrath is being revealed. Well, okay, but God's wrath is being revealed in different ways before February last year, and will continue once COVID becomes less of a news item. I won't say it disappears, it probably never will, but it becomes less of an issue. But his wrath is being revealed. How does God do it? Well, again, verse 24 onwards, we'll keep this for a couple of weeks' time, but in a nutshell, God is handing people over to their sinful choices. Sin is made the punishment for sin. Look at the world around you if you want to see the wrath of God. Meanwhile, I'll just close with this. Do you see, if you're a Christian, do you see the grace of God? You have been here. And too often in our lives, we too often are there because we still do worship false gods. We still do get tied up in little idolatries from time to time. We still do not allow the truth of who God is to break into our lives and form our lives as we should. We are inconsistent, terribly inconsistent. But you have received that third revelation. Not the revelation of God in creation, not the revelation of his wrath, but you by God's grace have received his righteousness. You have right with God through Jesus Christ. You have received the gospel. But how serious the situation is if you're not a Christian. Knowing God, yes you do, you reject him. You don't worship him. You don't give thanks. And in some way you are worshiping. In some way, you are worshiping. You may not recognize it as worship, but there is something which for you is giving you a combination of purpose and meaning in life, perhaps a sense of community, certain rituals that are part of your life. And that's giving you life. And it's giving you incentive. It's why you get up in the morning, perhaps. And if it's not Christ, then you're lost. There are two revelations that we are all experiencing of God's nature and power, of his wrath. But you need the third. You need the third. You need the revelation of his righteousness, which is in the gospel, which is the only power of God for salvation to everyone who believes.